and welcome to South Asia Chat, brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm Dr. Yogesh Joshi, Research Fellow at ISAS, your host for today's podcast. The simmering tensions underlying the fragile bilateral relationship between Asia's two largest economic and military powers have finally boiled over. The bloodbath at the Galwan Valley, where Indian and the People's Liberation Army soldiers clashed on the night of June 15, has the potential to transform Sino-Indian relations fundamentally. The military crisis is far from over. Even today, both India and China are amassing substantial number of troops on their side of the Himalayan frontier, while diplomatic negotiations for de-escalation and disengagement continue. In the wake of the unfortunate incident, India finds itself at a significant inflection point. The echo of Galwan is set to reverberate far and wide. To discuss the causes and implications of this recent Sino-Indian military crisis and its consequences for Asian and global geopolitics, we have with us today a very special guest, Ambassador Sivashankar Menon. Ambassador Menon needs no introduction. He has been one of the most well-known faces of Indian diplomacy and is a prolific scholar of Indian foreign and security policy. Presently, Ambassador Menon is a distinguished visiting research fellow at the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. His long career in public service spans diplomacy, national security, atomic energy, disarmament policy, and India's relations with its neighbors and major global powers. Ambassador Menon served as India's national security advisor to the Indian Prime Minister from 2010 to 2014, and as India's Foreign Secretary from 2006 until 2009. He has also served as Ambassador and High Commissioner of India to Israel, Sri Lanka, Pakistan. But most relevant to today's podcast, he was India's Ambassador to China at a very crucial period between 2000 and 2003, and was entrusted with restoring the bilateral relationship after India's 1998 nuclear weapons tests, and in fact guided the Sino-Indian relationship into the 21st century. Ambassador Menon's association with China has been a long one. During his service at the Ministry of External Affairs from 1992 to 1995, Ambassador Menon negotiated the first boundary-related agreement between the Republic of India and the People's Republic of China, and the root of the subsequent series of agreements that have maintained peace on the border despite ongoing boundary dispute, at least until now. He has also served as a special representative of the Prime Minister of India on the boundary issue from 2010 to 2014, and has dealt with India-China boundary and India-China relations since 1974. We could not have aspired for a more experienced and erudite voice to speak on Sino-Indian relations than Ambassador Menon. Ambassador Menon, welcome to South Asia Chat, and thank you so much for giving us your very valuable time.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for that very flattering introduction. It's good of you to have me.
Sure. To begin with, let me come down to the clash which happened on June 15. As we know, there have been no major bloodshed on the Sino-Indian frontier for nearly 45 years. How do you see this particular development and its significance for Sino-Indian relations?
Well, this is certainly a very significant development and a big change from what we have known now for about 40 years of relative peace on the border, where both sides worked, despite the undefined nature of the border and the boundary, to actually try and maintain the peace. I mean, the last deaths were in 1975. Those were by accident. And the last time we've had clashes of any scale between the militaries was really all the way back in 1967. So this is a very serious and significant development, and it does have major implications, not only for border management, but also for the relationship as a whole. And I think that is one reason why, because that it has actually shocked people in India. And it has led to a fundamental questioning of the relationship with China, especially questioning of why has China done this and done it at this time, when frankly the world, we, China, everybody is dealing with the health consequences of COVID, with the economic consequences of a global economic crash, actually. And that actually leads to very fundamental reexamination of the first principles on which the relationship was based. And I think that's natural. That's really why it's significant, because of what it's leading to downstream.
Right. So obviously the deaths are new, but the crises have been ever present in Sino-Indian boundary relations. We have had military crises in 2013, 2014, and 2017. What is different this time?
I think three things are different. One is the scope and scale of the Chinese intrusions. They've come across the LAC in several places. They've brought in huge force behind it on their side of the LAC to back this up. They have come and sat across the LAC and made a permanent presence. You mentioned 2013. 2013, within 2 weeks and a half, we had negotiated a return to the status quo ante, to going back to where we were. And certainly the numbers involved were never what we have seen this spring. I mean, they have been escalating. I mean, 2013 was much smaller than 2014 when 1,000 people came into Chumar, or than 2017 in Doklam. Now to have simultaneous intrusions in several places, permanent presence, very large numbers, the entire scale of this is quite different from anything we've seen before. So this is a crisis. I would not characterize everything that happened before as a crisis. Doklam perhaps was a near crisis, but that also was negotiated. It took a bit longer, 72 days, but the face-off spot is clear as a result. And both sides did withdraw from the face-off spot in Doklam in 2017. This one is still in the process of being discussed, both militarily and between diplomats of both sides. And we still, I mean, it's still an open question of how and whether and when it will be resolved.
Surely. So clearly the Chinese behavior this time is very different from these past encounters. What is the reasoning in Beijing, in your reckoning, which has led to this very different behavior on the part of PLA and China?
Well, I can't answer for China. I can't. And I don't want to get into guessing their motives.
Right.
You know, there are many people say it's a signal, it's a message. If this is messaging or signaling, it's very inefficient, because everybody's right. Guessing what the signal is. I mean, you're asking me, why are they doing this?
You know, right.
I don't think this is signaling. They have very simple ways of signaling if they want to.
Right.
I see it working at two levels. At the tactical level, India has been working to improve her infrastructure along the LAC, is about to complete a road which runs parallel to the LAC, which would improve her logistics capacity and so on. Maybe at the local tactical military level, the Chinese wanted to restore what they had, what they saw as the balance earlier. Maybe. I mean, that is one explanation. And you can always find some local tactical justification. But at the larger level, and this is why it is worrying, it seems to be part of a larger pattern of Chinese risk-taking and assertiveness across the board, whether it's in the Senkakus, where they've sent submarines, ships, whether it's in the South China Sea, where there is now talk of an ADIZ being declared there as well, whether it's Taiwan, where military aircraft have been sent across, whether it's Hong Kong, where despite the earlier agreements, China has decided to pass a security law, which will bring Chinese law enforcement into and security structures into Hong Kong without consulting the Hong Kong institutions, actually, or passing them through them. So if it's part of that broader pattern of behavior, then it becomes something very significant and very different. From our own point of view, what has happened, A, is a change in Chinese border management. B, is also calls into question the various agreements that we have signed with China on peace and tranquility along the border since the 1993 agreement, 96, etc. And that is something that now is open and must be questioned. It also calls into question the Chinese commitment to to the overall relationship and what they see as the future of this. Because I'm sure they are clever enough to know that action like this will have reactions in the Indian populace. You can already see calls for boycotts of Chinese goods gaining strength in India. Of course, there are also voices against it because this is a very important economic relationship. Now it includes even investment. And there are Indian sectors which work very closely with China. But the fact is that there is a reaction. And so what sort of relationship with India China seeks, that also becomes an open question.
So following the incident, there have been interactions at many levels, including military and diplomatic, to address the issue. What kind of resolution do you see taking place?
It's too early to say. I can only say that if you, logically, and I'm speaking purely theoretically, there are three possible ways forward out of this. I'm not talking about the nuts and bolts of how do you restore the status quo ante. That is a hard negotiation which will take some time. In the case of Sundarumchu in 1986, it took 7.5 years to actually resolve itself. No, but the relationship itself, it seems to me, can go three ways. In 1986, the Chinese came across the line of actual control, sat in a place they call Wangdong, we call Sundarumchu. And there was a whole host of reactions. Over the next 2 years, we engaged very deeply in discussions with the Chinese in countermeasures. We also brought force in. Arunachal was declared a state, was given granted statehood, which is territory that the Chinese claimed, and so on. And that process of engagement ended in the Rajiv Gandhi visit in 1988. That is the optimistic scenario. We have a crisis, which we then actually engage with, and we end up with a resolution which works for both sides and actually kicks the relationship onto a higher level. The other extreme, of course, is what happened between 1959 and 62, the steady slide into war. I mean, that is the other, where public opinion gets agitated, the media, parliament, reduce the scope for the government to actually negotiate and find a way forward. And frankly, each side starts suspecting each other. And in 62, you know what happened. In between, there's a whole host of possibilities. I want to clarify, I'm just saying today you're at the beginning of a crisis. You can't predict where this is going to go. A lot of it depends on why they did it in the first place. Also, how we take it and how we choose to respond. All that is still at the beginning. And frankly, we don't know enough about what is going on the ground yet, because a lot of it is speculation, is leaks, is motivated stories. And I don't think that we should, either propose or judge policy by what appears in Global Times or Republic TV. And that's, for me, that's not the place. So theoretically, there are several ways forward, but I think it's a little too early today to say what the resolution is going to be.
So as we saw after Sundarumchu, and you also mentioned in your book, The Choices, India's Choices, Sundarumchu paved the way for India, some progress in India-China boundary dispute, the resolution of India-China boundary dispute. And today also, there's a school of thought that says the crisis and the military stalemate might open the possibility of a boundary settlement. Is that a bridge too far at this point in time?
I can't tell. It's too early to say. As I said, yes, it's possible. I mean, I mentioned it as one of the possibilities. It's possible. Logically, yes. There are some factors today which are very different from 1986-87. Both countries have authoritarian leaderships. Both countries are under tremendous domestic stress, the economies and the pandemic. And I think the international situation is very different from what it was in 86, 87. The In 86, 87, actually, the asymmetry between the Indian and Chinese economies was not that much. Was in fact, they were roughly, in terms of GDP, roughly about equal. So it was possible to come to an understanding. Today, of course, Chinese economy is more than four times bigger than the Indian economy. But I, you know, I don't want to overstress that, because then what's kept the peace on the border so far for 40 plus years? What has kept the peace is the fact that the effective balance on the border is not as asymmetrical as the GDP figures or military budget comparisons and all these things which pop culture indulges in. It's not as asymmetric or unbalanced as those would suggest. And I think that's what actually has kept the balance, kept the peace so far along the line.
I wanted to pick up on your last comment, and this is very much, you know, the part of Indian diplomacy is India's military preparedness. You know, that has been the bedrock of India's engagement with China. In fact, in the first time Indira Gandhi opened up after the Sino-Indian War of 1962 was after the Nathula incident of 1967, where we felt that we have enough conventional deterrence in place. How important is the show of military resolve in bringing the Chinese to the negotiating table on the Himalayan frontier?
Well, as I said, you know, so long as there is an effective balance and a level of mutual deterrence, in the sense that both sides can embarrass the other, I think the peace has held, and both sides have not just kept the peace, but kept the status quo. Not much has changed all along the line in this period. So that, to me, is important. Whether that is still so going forward, as I said, why do we have this crisis? We still don't know. We don't have one explanation for why we have this crisis. Have the Chinese come to the conclusion that the balance has changed? Do they think they have a moment of opportunity to improve things? Or do they feel they must react to something? We don't know, because they're the ones who've done this. So frankly, your question needs to be addressed to them. As a general principle, yes, it is true that China responds to the relative balance of power. I mean, historically as well, it's not a new phenomenon. And that China is very sensitive to shifts in the balance of power as well. But, you know, that's a general academic principle, and the actual application of it is much more complicated.
Sure. So the next specific point before I move into the larger implications of the current military crisis on India's Sino-Indian political and economic relations, I want to ask you, what happens to the boundary agreements which both sides have so assiduously negotiated since 1993? The clash at Galwan kind of brings into question the efficacy of these agreements, but also it creates certain kind of great mistrust, and that might lead to more accidental escalation rather than a more intentional escalation. So what happens to these boundary agreements now?
Well, I think that's really a question. It does raise questions about China's commitment to the agreements that we have not just signed, but actually implemented for several years since 1993. Whether that commitment is still there, whether she still intends to implement them, that is why these events, and in several places, are so significant, because they call into question the commitment of those, of the commitment, China's commitment to those agreements, in which case we have a whole new situation to deal with. And frankly, any prudent government will have to take steps to prepare for that kind of situation, now that it's in question. But we will only know the answer to your question really at the end of the negotiation, as we see, as we progress through an attempt to restore the status quo ante, and we see what the Chinese responses. Frankly, you and I don't know what they are saying in the negotiations, both sides. I mean, we're not. And I think we need to be a little careful before jumping to conclusions. But it does raise a question, you're right, about those. And I would expect both sides, therefore, but especially the Indian side, to start taking steps to respond to that potential situation.
We have spoken at length about the military balance, you know, and the prospects of military escalation and military disengagement. Now I'm going to come down to the economics and the larger politics of Sino-Indian bilateral relations. So first of all, one of the ways for India to kind of signal its resolve to China is the use of weaponizing India's asymmetric economic interdependence with China. How effective do you think would that kind of a strategy be?
Well, it's clear that India's economic leverage over China is limited but exists, especially at a time when the global economy is in this tremendous downturn, when markets for Chinese goods, and not just for Chinese goods, but in the last 6 years, Chinese investment in India has gone from something like $1.8 billion to $26 billion or so, estimated. So Chinese investment, Chinese project exports to India have grown significantly. So there is some leverage, but this is a relationship, like any economic relationship, which benefits both sides. The Indian consumer gets cheap products. India gets a whole host of things which actually enable it to export. Some of the APIs for pharmaceuticals, for instance, the automobile industry imports parts from China. So this is a symbiotic relationship. You can certainly cut it, but it will hurt both sides to do so. And there will be pain on both sides. Is this an effective answer to the situation on the border? I don't think so. I mean, this is not a direct, oh, you cut something here, I won't import this, and then the situation on the border settles itself. Life doesn't quite work like that. So there is clearly, feelings are running very high in India. There are calls for boycott from supporters of the ruling party from across the board, actually. And but we have to see how this debate plays out. It has come also at a time when already there is a turning inward in all the big countries, whether it is Prime Minister Modi, President Xi Jinping, they've all been calling for self-reliance to deal with the world after the pandemic, after COVID. So we have to see how the economic argument plays out, because everybody's priority now is going to be to get their economies up and running again. And frankly, cutting links with the cheapest and most efficient source of what you need doesn't sound to me like the best way to get your economy up and running again. But we have to see which impulse pervades, whether the anger, the emotion, the political and the drive, that the pressure that generates on the political leadership works, or whether the economic logic of interdependence actually prevails. I suspect it will be a balance of both. There will be critical areas like telecom and so on, where not only does government have the capability, but government will also decide to limit exposure in areas which are of critical strategic importance. Telecom is an obvious example, the 5G, for instance. But there are other areas where I don't think, I mean, trading, normal trading relationships in goods and so on, consumer goods, those kinds of things, I don't see that much advantage for anyone in cutting those off. So we'll have to see how this develops. But I would expect, yes, there will be, and there has been a contraction in the trade anyway because of the economic situation in both countries. So we have to see, this is in some ways an opportunity to recalibrate the economic relationship. There was a huge imbalance in China's favor, and maybe this is a time when both sides can actually apply their minds to improving it. rather than just repeating the patterns of the past.
Sure. So the Sino-Indian balance, you know, the relations between China and India have seen both competition at the level of, you know, the bilateral relationship, but there's also been a lot of cooperation at the larger global level, whether it is multilateralism, climate change, global economy. What does the border crisis do to this larger cooperation which India and China have shown for the last 2 to 3 decades?
I think what it does is there have always been differences in this relationship. And it's always been a mixed relationship with both competition and cooperation at the same time. There have been periods when the elements of cooperation predominated. But I think what this does is that the elements of competition, of the adversarial elements in the relationship, will actually get heightened. And now how far that will go, as I said, depends on how we resolve this crisis. How do we move out of it? Or do we not resolve it? Do we show an inability to deal with the issues that it's thrown up? And if there's lack of clarity, frankly, it will affect the relationship, because that's as bad, if not, you know, in some ways even worse, because then there will be, as you said, mutual suspicion that the other side is not willing to keep to agreements, so there's not much point getting into agreements. So you start doing hedging, you start doing other actions, and basically the adversarial elements take over the relationship. But that is not something that I think today you can predict. And both governments have actually been trying to signal that they would like to bring their relationship back on track, that they see the value of the elements of cooperation. You'll notice how careful they've been about what they have said about each other in public. Governments. I'm not saying that the media, social media and so on have also followed the same restraints, but certainly the governments have been careful. And I think that suggests to me that both want to find a way out. Now, whether they can or not, I don't know. And whether they show the wisdom, they have the ability, I don't know. Because frankly, it shouldn't have happened in the first place. But now that China's done it, one has to wonder why she's done it, and she has to actually offer some reassurance and some explanation, some guarantees that this won't happen again.
So turning back to history, both Moscow and Washington, D.C. has always played a very important role, both in the minds of Beijing as well as New Delhi, in calibrating Sino-Indian relationship. Today, again, we see similar arguments being made that the crisis would increase the relative value of Washington, D.C. as well as Moscow in bringing the Sino-Indian relationship either to an even keel, or for that matter, creating certain deterrent capabilities, particularly for New Delhi. This whole argument about India shifting towards the U.S. How do you see the role of the U.S. as well as Russia in the current Sino-Indian bilateral dispute?
Well, let me unwrap that question, because there's two parts to that. To my mind, India-China relations have always been driven by endogenous factors, not by exogenous factors, not by Moscow or Washington or by others, that there have been enough, there is enough to the bilateral relationship per se, that irrespective of what happens in the larger global context, these relations have had a motive force of their own. And these are determined ultimately in Beijing and in Delhi, not elsewhere. I want to make that absolutely clear. But certainly, during the Cold War, there have been periods when the US thought of India as a countervailing power to China in the second Eisenhower administration or in the Kennedy administration, for instance. And certainly India, when Bangladesh happened, for instance, the Bangladesh crisis in 1971, did look to the Soviet Union for balancing arrangements. So, yes, outside powers enter the calculus. And what China has done now, I think, has certainly convinced several people who maybe were not quite so sure that in India, that of the value of a much tighter relationship with the US. To counterbalance what they see as an aggressive, assertive China. Now, it could work both ways. If you look at the US reaction so far to this particular crisis, President Trump has offered mediation, which is actually a neutral reaction. I mean, that both countries, China and India, have said no thank you, one politely, one not so politely. The US has also simultaneously signaled support for India being in the G7. And I think has Secretary of State Pompeo has said, you know, that the G7 needs to discuss China. Now, that is a political statement of alignment, which is very, very different from what we've been used to in the past. But the Indian government has not responded to the second part of that at all. They, I'm sure, would be happy to go to the G7. They've been before two previous G7 meetings as invitees. So there is political support. There have been statements by the Assistant Secretary of State and others. There's political support. There's an offer of mediation. But ultimately, I think India knows that whatever problems there are on the border need to be dealt with on the border itself by India herself. The US strategy of the free and open Indo-Pacific is a useful strategy for the maritime domain, which is where the contention actually takes place between the US and China. But it's not a continental strategy. And India is both a continental and a maritime power and has problems on the continent with China. This boundary dispute is on land, is on the continent. So that's where Russia becomes important as a fellow continental power in Asia. And a very significant military power in Asia. Russia has always been an important factor. So it seems to me that by provoking this crisis, by what she has done, China could actually strengthen both India-US relations and India-Russia relations. All our major military platforms are Russian, and it would be natural for us to turn to Russia when we strengthen ourselves.
Sure. Now, that's a very interesting thought and goes much against the grain of the debate which is happening right now, which kind of
but
sees
not
these things.
Conventional wisdom.
Sure. So the Sino-Indian bilateral relationship in the last one decade has had a profound shadow on the subcontinent. What does it mean for the subcontinent? Where does subcontinent see itself after the recent crisis between India and China? What does it imply for South Asia?
Well, you know, for most of the other countries in the Indian subcontinent, India is an overwhelming presence. Because there are cross-border ethnicities across each of our borders with each of our neighbors. There are affinities of culture, of language, of religion. Traditionally, these borders have been open. These are new state boundaries which we have created, many of which go against the grain of economic and social life in those regions. Some are open borders, as with Nepal. And these are new states which are still creating their nationalisms. So therefore, we have had a situation where most of India's smaller neighbors have sought to hedge between India against India's overwhelming presence in their lives. And this is understandable in new states where nationalism is still a work in progress. Or nationhood is still a work in progress. And so when it used to be during the Cold War and to bring in, I mean, you saw Sri Lanka would try and rely on the US, bring in others. Today, China is the rising power. And as India-China relations get worse, it's natural that the smaller neighbors will try and get what they can from both India and China and play one off against the other. But the fundamentals of the affinities, the economic interdependence, and the fact that our security is interlinked, all of us in the subcontinent, I think those fundamentals still remain. It's up to India to go out and actually work them and thereby to build a peaceful periphery for itself. Because that is essential. If we want to transform India, we need to have a periphery which is at peace with itself and peace with us. And that's something we need to work on, integrating economically with our neighbors in the subcontinent, being a net provider of security and a source of security within the subcontinent itself, and working on the affinities and using those to reassure and work with our neighbors. That, I, for me, is the way forward. But what I see now, frankly, is not surprising. I mean, this is normal, and I think we should learn to live with it as well. You know, the noise, the balancing, the attempts to play one off against the other. Okay, if I were a smaller neighbor, I'd do that too.
Surely, we are coming towards the end of the podcast, but I want to ask, I can't leave you without asking one very important question. What, in your opinion, if India has to do three things today to set a long-term strategy, not only to take, you know, to maintain the balance of power with China, to have that cordial relationship, which is basically built upon respect, what are the three things India should plan to do?
If only life were so simple, right? Three things. Well, there are three things that I think should be done, but these are not exclusive, or, you know, it's not. Vis-a-vis China itself, I think we need a new strategic framework that we both understand for managing the relations. The old framework from 1980, that no longer works. I think we need a new modus vivendi. That requires a strategic dialogue where we sit down and look at our core interests, both sides, and see how we manage the differences, whether we can settle them, etc. That's vis-a-vis China itself. But secondly, I think India needs to engage with the rest of the world, with certainly with Southeast Asia. You cannot run an active political, military strategy abroad if it's not backed up by economic interdependence and relationships. My favorite example is that we need to be in RCEP. We need to negotiate a way of being in RCEP. We need to work with our neighbors. And I think that's very important. Somebody once said, my foreign policy is 8% growth. And there is some truth in that, that we need that. But thirdly, and most important, I think the world is between orders. And at a time when the world is between orders, when the old so-called liberal international order no longer works, when the two greatest powers on earth, the US and China, are actually revisionist powers, I think we need to start transitioning, at least in the subcontinent, to being a provider of order. We need to work with our neighbors. And that's very important that we do this. I mentioned already, integrate our economies, be a net provider of security, et cetera, within the neighborhood, but make this a neighborhood of peace. So that we have a peaceful periphery within which we can operate in these uncertain times when the globe itself is so uncertain.
This has been very enlightening past half an hour for me personally, but I'm also sure that our listeners would agree with my assessment. Thank you, Mr. Ambassador Menon, for joining us today at South Asian Chat. We deeply value your insights and the time which you have given us today.
Thank you.
If you wish to learn more about ISAS, please visit our website, ISAS.org. www.nus.edu.sg.